Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. In this podcast, we'll talk about the new book, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society, with the editor of that book, the Associate Director of the Center for Science and Culture, Dr. John G. West. In this episode, we'll discuss how some have tried to construe C.S. Lewis's views in order to make them better fit their own, as well as Lewis's views on Darwinism and intelligent design.
You point out that philosopher Michael Peterson, in arguing that Lewis would reject intelligent design theories, quoted Lewis as saying, quote, "Everyone now knows that man has evolved from lower types of life," unquote. When what Lewis really had written was, and you point this out in the book, "Everyone now knows about evolution, though of course some educated people disbelieve it. Everyone has been told that man has evolved from lower types of life." Why is this distinction important, and why would the philosopher willingly leave out these key phrases?
Boy, I have to tread carefully here because I want to try to be charitable. I would say from my many years as a former college professor that if I had a student who used ellipses in the creative way that Dr. Peterson did in that quote, they would end up having a problem when it came to grading. I can't answer as to why he did it. I debated him once and confronted him with it. He didn't respond about that particular case, so I don't know.
Seems to me there's only one response, which is either that was a gross error because you're creating a phrase that says the opposite of what you're claiming they say, with clever deletion of words.
Why this is important is that with all the caveats that Lewis added, where he was basically pointing out that he was describing what people say and what the culture says. And if you actually look at the context of that quote, it comes from Mere Christianity. He's not even talking about evolution. He's actually looking for an analogy to explain something spiritual. And so he's saying, you know, this is what people currently believe, and to help people understand another truth. And so he wasn't actually making a truth claim about evolution, yay or nay, in that particular passage. Mm-hmm. And that's true in some other areas too. He sometimes skirted some of that, because Lewis actually wrote privately that he understood the evolutionary theory was sort of almost, he didn't use this term like a religion, but is the de facto worldview that people have. And so he was somewhat skittish sometimes. Later on in life, he was more direct about a frontal attack because he understood that this was sort of so much the status quo, almost the culture's religion. And certainly, actually, later in life, he talked about the religion of evolutionism, which really as a cosmic philosophy. And, you know, think of people today like Richard Dawkins, who thinks that Darwin's theory helps you become an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Or, as we write about in the book, the people around February 12th every year don't celebrate Lincoln's birthday. They have Darwin Day celebrations, Darwin Day gospel concerts, Darwin Day birthday cakes. I mean, just think of that. Who celebrates Einstein's birthday? I mean, I know a lot of science geeks, including people who love physics, who do not celebrate Einstein's birthday, especially with Einstein mock gospel concerts. There's something going on here that Lewis put his finger on the pulse. It's more than just science.
You write that evolution is an elastic term, and we've mentioned that earlier, and I'm sure you talk about it a whole lot as a part of your work with the Discovery Institute. Evolution is an elastic term. It can mean many things. Why is it important for people to realize that?
Because they may get bamboozled into seemingly agreeing with views that they don't really agree with. Elastic terms help persuade people without really persuading them. And on evolution, where it matters is that I think people's de facto view when they hear evolution, oh, things took a long time, it developed over time. Well, if that's all it meant, then that really doesn't explain why there's this controversy, both culturally and also scientifically. And really, it becomes an inoffensive term. But if you really understand that in Darwin's view, this was this blind, unguided, impersonal process, and that dictates not only our physical capacities, but Darwin was very clear, it was our mental capacities, our moral beliefs, even our religious beliefs, all are the product of this impersonal material process. Everything is reduced to that. Well, then you begin to understand that this is a very consequential question as to whether it's true or not.
You alluded to this before, but in the book, you write Darwin's own theory haunted him in regards to human reason. And you quote Darwin saying, quote, "But then with me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the conviction of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the conviction of a monkey's mind if there are any convictions in such a mind?" And you point out that this passage was underlined by C.S. Lewis himself in his copy of Darwin's writings. Are such concerns legitimate for the non-theist, and how would Lewis envision reason as an argument for theism?
Well, again, Lewis points out that even having a conversation about whether you think theism or atheism is true, you're presuming that there are basic rules of logic and evidence and that you can have a discussion and debate. And so if a position fundamentally undercuts that, it literally becomes nonsensical. You can't say A and not A are true at the same time. And so I think this does really have an impact for theist and atheist alike if the atheists are wanting to be honest about the evidence. This is one of the strongest potential objections to just a blind materialistic worldview. Now, again, I think Lewis would also point out we spend a lot of time trying to avoid and evade that, but I do think that that is a really powerful argument. And Lewis, he started out as being an atheist and agnostic by his teenage years, and he was troubled by an argument from Undesign, which is pain, suffering, and evil that I think all theists as well as atheists are troubled by. But then he ended up coming and believing in God. Well, how was that? Well, he began to confront certain things that just couldn't be accounted for materialistically, and that ended up pointing him towards God. And so reason was one of those things that, again, you really have two choices. How did everything begin? Was it a blind, impersonal beginning, or was it a personal beginning? Do things ultimately go back just to blind matter emotion, or is there mind at the beginning of it? And those are two fundamental choices. And Lewis thought that from our own experience, we really don't see mindless processes creating mind. And so there are a lot of reasons to believe that mind was the beginning of the process. Well, then that's outside of matter. And you're talking about a transcendent mind by the time you get to explaining the universe. And that does not definitively prove God, but what it does is God suddenly becomes one of the key options on the table. Whereas in the scientific materialist worldview, oh, it's not even an option. It's just superstition. Hell, you could be even stupid to believe that. That's just like believing in fairies. But when you understand the logic of how do you justify reason and mind to begin with, Lewis said, that's a pretty powerful way of putting God as one of the options back on the table.
You conclude chapter 6, Darwin and the Dock, by arguing that Lewis's most important contribution to the evolution debate was his highlighting the all-too-human frailties of modern science. What did you mean by that?
Lewis, in the book The Discarded Image, made very clear that science is a human enterprise, and so it is subject to human fallibility, and that our own prejudices and things can influence it. And so he looked askance at people who tried to claim dogmatically that this was the only right way to understand something and that you couldn't even raise questions about it. And Lewis was very good, again, that science itself depends on certain basic rules of logic. So that means that you don't just need to be a scientist in order to be able to question some of the claims coming out of the sciences, especially when it comes to morality and ethics and public policy.
Speaking with Dr. John West of the Discovery Institute about his new book, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society, you point out that Lewis, at one point in his life, considered the design arguments from nature to be the weakest argument for theism. What changed his mind?
Well, actually, probably till the end of his life, he may have thought it to be the weakest argument for a personal Christian God. He thought it was a strong argument against materialism. So part of it was, how far does it take you? I'd actually say that Lewis ended up prefiguring many of the arguments or the way of approaching things of modern intelligent design theorists, because prior to, say, the last 20, 30, 40 years, the more classical version of the design argument was you look at design nature and then you get the God of the Bible. And as modern design theorists point out, well, design can prove or bring to the conclusion that there was real intelligence and purposeful agent behind the universe. Whether that's the God of the Bible or something else requires more argument. It's not because we happen to believe that it's space aliens or something. It's just that science itself can only take you so far. And so humble about how much can be established by this. And I think this is where Lewis came out. As you point out, he was very troubled by what he called the argument from Undesign, pain and suffering. How do you justify a benevolent Christian God when you see all the pain and suffering in the world? But again, Lewis began to see these things. One was, we've already discussed, the argument from reason that doesn't really seem to be able to be accounted for by materialism. So that opens the door suddenly to, well, you need to consider things more than just blind materialism. That opens the door to considering God. Then morality. Where do we get morality from? Now, you can go the materialist route and say, well, it's just all product of survival of the fittest. It's just what you've been bred by your culture. There's no real right or wrong. Most people in their heart of hearts, though, are not going to do that, because that will require them to say, well, you know, Nazis, they killed 6 million Jews, millions of other people. Stalin killed millions of people. That was just their culture. I may not like it, but that was their culture. Most people know in their heart of hearts. They're not going to argue that, because they understand there is something that's really right or wrong. And then Lewis says, well, if that's true, where do we get that feeling from? Even the very argument from Undesigned, where we're complaining about the universe and saying, it's wrong. How dare you be so cruel? Well, what does that mean? Where do you get that standard from? You're actually saying there's a transcendent standard out there by which you can judge what happens in the universe. And when Lewis realized that, a light bulb went on. He said, well, if I'm trying to judge the universe based on some transcendent standard, where does that transcendent standard come from? If you really had just a materialist worldview, all you could say is, well, that's the way things are. I may not like it in my personal preference, but that's the way things are. So you have the argument from reason pointing that there's something beyond nature. Then the argument from morality points to, well, there must be a moral lawgiver. And that, again, doesn't prove the Christian God, but it opens the door that you now have to seriously consider theism. And then you have the argument from beauty, because I think most people think that beauty is real and that the things that we celebrate in the arts and music and the beauty of the butterfly are real. And they're not satisfied by, say, Darwin trying to explain it all away as part of sexual selection. And frankly, even most biologists aren't satisfied by that Darwinian explanation. And so Lewis said, well, where does beauty come from? And again, this goes back to you can't have an effect that's greater than the beginning cause. So if you're actually going to try to explain beauty as something real, you have to have a cause that is capable of showing beauty that's real, that's not just a material cause. And so then that also pointed to something transcendent. And then finally, this argument from functional complexity. Lewis pointed out that evolutionists often argue, well, look, the oak tree comes from an acorn. Human beings start as a fetus in the womb. So you can actually see evolution all over, you know, the smaller and cruder things developing into more purposeful, grander things. But Lewis said, if you actually look at reality, that's not what happens. Every acorn actually comes from a fully developed oak tree. Every human embryo requires two fully developed human parents. And so his point is that this functional complexity, in order to explain it, you actually have to go outside the system. And he says, you know, people say, well, it's just laws of nature. Laws of nature just generate it. Well, he says, well, think about the laws of nature. Think about the law of gravity when you're playing pool. Well, that law of gravity will explain where the balls will go once they've been hit. But who provides the initial input? Laws of nature don't do that. You have to have some input from outside the system. So he actually thought this sort of functional complexity we saw throughout nature helped really point to the need for an outside intelligent cause. And in fact, that fourth argument was probably the most directly like, say, modern intelligent design arguments. But I think, again, Lewis had the appreciation that all of that added up points to the need for a transcendent cause and maybe even a designer. It doesn't then answer the final question, is this the God of the Bible? That requires other arguments. And for Lewis, those other arguments included historical claims about Jesus and the Bible and the resurrection and things like that. And again, in this way, Lewis was very actually similar to modern intelligent design theorists who try to say the science and reason will take you so far, and then you have to add additional arguments if you want to get to, say, the God of the Bible.
But that's a similar argument, isn't it, in terms of the limitations on materialist science views, who are now trying to say, if science, quote unquote, says something, then they want to claim or assert that science is also prescribing political policy decisions based on that science, and they're not limiting themselves. It's a similar kind of thing, isn't it? One side's recognizing their limitation, while the other side is not.
Well, and Lewis, of course, was very concerned about that mindset among some scientists. And he made clear that, you know, there are lots of bench level scientists. They're not doing this, but the scientific propagandists who often do have some scientific training and they claim because of that, therefore society has to do this. And so, yes, Lewis is very concerned about that sort of extrapolation.
That concludes this edition of ID the Future. If you would like more information about C.S. Lewis and his views on science, please visit cslewisweb.com. Also, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting the Center for Science and Culture. Go to discovery.org, click the Science and Culture tab, then click the Donate tab at the top of the page. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.